being more than three members in the room and it being after 2:15, we will call the meeting to order. We don't have a quorum yet, so we won't work on the minutes now. And today we're continuing our conversations, as I've said to members of the committee and also sort of said to people who might be coming here. I want this to be much more in the line of a philosophical conversation than dealing with the actual bills and projects and that sort of thing at this time. Again, I guess we have different people there, so I apologize for not doing the time really right for the Parks and Trails people, but this looks like it's a much calmer group, so I think we'll probably do a little bit better. So this is the part of the legacy bill that deals with arts, heritage, and history. And we have a set of people listed, and we'll just start with Sue Jens is first on the agenda from the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Arts Board. Ms. Jens.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sue Jens. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Arts Board. And with me at the table today is Mark Turner, who is the Executive Director of the Five Wings Arts Council based in Staples, Minnesota. And if you'll permit us, we're going to tag team today so that I can give you a little bit more detail about the Minnesota State Arts Board. Mark can give you a little more detail about our partners, the regional arts councils. We're going to give you a very brief kind of high-level summary of what we do, how we do it, and the outcomes that we're achieving. And I know there will be time for questions, so we'll go somewhat quickly and come back and deal with those at the end. And you have your handouts. The Minnesota State Arts Board is a state agency. We are a non-cabinet-level executive branch agency. Our roles and responsibilities are outlined in state statute, Chapter 129D, but I've given you the one sentence that really boils down the essence of what we do. We stimulate and encourage the creation, performance, and appreciation of the arts in the state. Minnesota has been a long-time national leader in the arts. We were the second state to create an agency within state government to support the arts. We did that in 1903. We were the second state to create a regional structure so that there's a state and a companion regional structure. We did that in 1977. And, of course, we were the first state and so far the only state that has passed an amendment to our Constitution that will guarantee long-term funding for arts and cultural heritage. Briefly about the structure, we have 11 members on our board. Those members are appointed by the governor and they serve with the consent of the Senate. They represent the 8 congressional districts and then we have 3 at-large members. We have 18 full-time staff members. And really the heart of our work is the advisory committees. We use volunteers, citizen volunteers, about 300 per year, who come in and they do really the heavy lifting. They read grant applications and they provide a set of recommendations that our board uses to determine how to award the funds that we have available. Those meetings happen in the open. We follow the open meeting laws. Members of the public are welcome to participate and attend. I didn't give you all of Chapter 129D04. It's rather long, but I picked out a few of the key responsibilities that our agency has in statute. And you'll see it's really about being a source of financial support for the arts in the state of Minnesota. We consider requests for grants, loans, and other forms of assistance. We distribute those monies to a variety of different individuals and organizations. We are an advisor and a partner with other state agencies. We have longstanding partnerships with the Department of Public Safety, with Department of Administration, Office of Tourism, and others. And the last of the duties that I picked out here is that we are also the fiscal agent dispersing appropriations to 11 regional arts councils. And by fiscal agent, it means we review plans, we review their financial reports, and we monitor their activities. They are autonomous, but we have oversight responsibility. I'm going to hand off to Mark, who will talk a little bit more about the regional.
Okay, at this point, we do have a quorum, and Representative Ward looks as if he's read the minutes totally thoroughly.
I'll move them.
Okay.
Minutes. I'd like to ask about the second.
Okay. All those in favor of the ward motion say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. We've adopted the minutes. Okay. Yes. Okay. Go on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As Sue mentioned, my name is Mark Turner. I'm the director of the Five Wings Regional Arts Council, which, if you look at your little map there, is right in the middle. Currently, I'm the president of the Regional Arts Council Forum. So if you mention, as you see on your map, there's 11 regional arts councils across the state. And all 11 regional arts councils directors form a group, really a consortium, to guarantee, to talk about, to do networking, to do best practices, and to really guarantee that we work well with the Minnesota City Arts Board to do really good statewide planning and statewide projects around every 87 counties in the state. As you see, they're based on county lines, and that's one thing we take pride in, is we have reasonable access to legacy funds in each county in the state of Minnesota. And also, the next thing on the slide talks about local decision making. Each one of those regional arts councils is an independent nonprofit organization with their own board of directors. And again, what that does is really guarantees that there's local decision making going on, because each of those regional arts councils has those board of directors are comprised of local individuals representing each of those counties.
You know, if I can just ask a question, when we set up the regional arts councils, there were along the lines, there were some regional governance councils of some sort. And was there some problem about the continued existence of those? So do the arts councils exist independently of them then?
Madam Chair, what you're referring to is regional development commissions.
Yes, that's right.
At one time, I believe there's a regional development commission that covered every essentially region or county in the state. And I wouldn't say that there's problems with those, but there's different situations that happened that it just made the most sense on the local people's level to actually to have their own planning process for that. So it's been a very healthy break, in my opinion, to move away from those regional development commissions, and we've been able to be a lot more flexible and serve the people a lot better.
Okay, but you kept the same boundaries or the same?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Essentially, if it's not broke, don't fix it.
Okay.
Moving on to local arts development, the regional arts councils really take a lot of pride in that. We really see ourselves as the rubber that hits the track, so to speak, real grassroots efforts. We're really close to the field in most cases, as you see the boundaries. They're really small. A lot of them are smaller regions where we can really have a lot of input from the public, from the constituents that we serve, and also be flexible, again, as I said before, to make changes and really serve those constituents. Many times the only arts contact in the region is with the regional arts council, so it really bridges a lot of gaps between services and funding. So I think we can move on. As I mentioned earlier, each regional arts council has their own board of directors, and they take their responsibilities very seriously about establishing programs that meet the needs in the region. So if you look at each 11 regional arts council, there's a lot of similarities, but there's also a lot of differences. And that's really been up to the individual constituents that run that organization of how it best serves their needs. along with that, the Regional Arts Council is defining and establishing their own criteria for funding, and that goes back to that same process that's really guaranteeing that the needs in that particular region are being met to the best of their ability. And they also award their own funds. And when I say that, essentially, you see the process of the legacy funds coming out of this committee and going to the State Arts Board as the fiscal agent for Regional Arts Councils. But when grantees or the services that are provided, they really come from that local Regional Arts Council. When the check comes from for a legacy grant, it's coming from Staples to serve Staples or Staples to serve Brainerd, rather than coming from a Twin Cities organization, which really serves a lot of weight in rural Minnesota.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I see that define and establish criteria for funding and eligibility. Do all of the arts councils use the same criteria, or are there different for each one?
You know, we all use essentially a base criteria, and that's, you know, artistic merit, ability of the applicant to carry out the project, and a need in the community for that project or for that arts activity or service. Those are three overarching guidelines that all the regional arts councils use. How those are interpreted may be a little different depending on each region, but yes, we use the same criteria.
Thank you.
All right, we'll segue just for a moment now into the legacy amendment. Obviously, that's what this committee is focused on. And here is the language from the Constitution. You're all familiar with it, but just as a reminder that the funds from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund is only spent on arts, arts education, arts access, and to preserve Minnesota's history and cultural heritage. Those, all four of those areas are things that we are involved in. We think we play an important role. We know that it's one of the things that really makes Minnesota a particularly unique place. We wanted to share with you a little bit about the planning process that we did as a system, and then we'll talk more specifically about what we're doing separately. I'll start with a little bit of information about at the beginning, back 4 years ago when the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund was just brand new. There weren't, in fact, the dollars weren't even coming in yet. A committee much like this was charged with making decisions about how to allocate those funds. And there was a lot of conversation and a lot of thoughtful work went into that. And there was also a charge given to the Arts Board, to the Minnesota Historical Society and the Humanities Center to be responsible for coordinating a planning committee, bringing together, I think there were 13 of us at the time who were assigned to be on that committee, and to try to understand or put some framework around this thing called the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. What is it? What should it be? What are the aspirations that Minnesotans have? So we did, I think it was 6 public hearings around the state. There was web input. There was a great deal of thoughtful work that went into that. And there was a report that was provided to the legislature in January of 2010. And we can come back to some of the specifics about that later if you wish. But things like creating and performing artistic works, preserving Minnesota's history and cultural heritage from its earliest days to the present, disseminating information, interpretation, all of those were the key areas that were stressed by Minnesotans that they hoped that the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund dollars would accomplish over time.
Mm-hmm. What you're looking at now is really, as what Sue mentioned, a pretty rigorous timeline that the State Arts Board, partnering with the Regional Arts Councils, did with to put together that 10-year plan and 25-year framework. And we don't have to go through this in particular, but what I do want to mention is, you know, these say 2009, 2010, but this is ongoing stuff that we continually do on a day-to-day basis. I know it's the same with the State Arts Board. I know it's the same with the Regional Arts Councils. We're very grounded with our field and the constituents, and what I'm trying to say is we're doing a good job with all this. What I do want to touch on is with our vision is that just a couple of these to highlight, and the first one talks about connecting people of all ages and cultures and fostering understanding and respect. I know that many of the programs that I've seen around the state that's been legacy funded through both the State Arts Board and the Regional Arts Councils, it really has brought a whole cross-section of people together to do those arts activities. I've been in this field for 20-plus years and when funding was pretty tight. And essentially what happened was it seemed to be a move towards funding projects that were really, really mainstream. But what the legacy dollars has done now and what we've really tried to gear that towards is to really dig a little deeper and find those things that are that have cultural diversity, that are meeting different audiences. So we're really more than scratching the surface, but really finding those people and giving those people access to the arts. And what we're looking at, what you're looking here is a 25-year, the guiding principles. And I do want to mention in our planning process, I know the State Arts Board has a rigorous planning process, and what the Regional Arts Councils do, each individual Regional Arts Council is required to do a needs assessment and every 4 years, but a total planning process every 2 years, which is called our biennial planning, and we produce a biennial plan. And what's happening is we're using this as a framework, and during that planning process, going back and touching on each one of these key principles to make sure and ground ourselves that the programs that we're developing now and into the future are always coming back to what we initially said we were going to do. So these have turned out to be very good tools for us to use. And the same with the goals. I mean, we really, in our planning process, coming back and you look at these goals, and some of them are pretty lofty. But I'm proud to say I think we're really working towards these in a realistic way, and we're making some progress. I mean, I'll get to it a little bit maybe later in the presentation, but I can see really a real momentum happening in Minnesota right now with the arts, cultural heritage, even our friends in history as well. There's really a momentum moving. Really, the legacy dollars, in my opinion, to use the metaphor, is really just put a bellows to the smoldering embers, and now we have a pretty good flame going. So I think it's really time to put more fuel on the fire, to be honest. It's really making a difference. So
this slide gives you a sense of the dollars that have come into the Arts Board and the Regional Arts Council system. And on mine, it's very small, but the very left-hand bar is 2002-2003. And that really was the high water point for the State Arts Board and Regional Arts Councils. That was a time when there was $25 million for the biennium coming out of the general fund. And then you'll see it dip down as things got a little bit more difficult with the state's budget and the state's economy. And we made a little progress. We bumped back up again in 2008-2009. We were at $20 million. And then you see the blue bars on top is the addition of the legacy funds. And I give this to you to show a couple of things. One, that the state has consistently been investing in the arts through the general fund, and we know that the legacy funds are supplementing that. You can see that that's really been an important increase in the investment. We're now at $60 million for the biennium, and I think 4 years ago when the legacy funds were new and the planning was just starting, there were a number of people who thought $60 million is more than enough. You'll be able to fund everything that's out there and have money left over. And what we have found is that we could have twice as much and still not meet all of the needs. And there are two reasons for that. One is because there are a lot of really important activities and programs that are receiving very small amounts of money from the state of Minnesota. And those investments could be higher, as Mark said. We could be investing a lot more. The other thing that's true is because of the legacy funds, we in the Regional Arts Councils have been able to expand the kinds of activities and programs and applicants that we are able to fund. So we're now doing things that we couldn't have done 4 years ago, and we're reaching people that we could not have reached 4 years ago. So the 60 might look like a lot of money, but in a moment we'll get to some of the requests and grants. And right now we're meeting about 50% of the demand that's out there. And we know that it will only grow from there. So I'm going to hand back to Mark, and we'll start to talk a little bit about what we're doing with those $60 million.
Thanks, Sue. What you're looking at here is the 2012-13 General Fund and Legacy Funds. And really what we want to show you this is to show you the breakdown of where the money's going between the Minnesota State Arts Board and the Regional Arts Councils. And and the breakdown that's in the Constitution between arts and arts access, arts education, and cultural heritage. I do want to point out in this slide is that what happens is there is these committees talk about is how much money goes to both the Arts Board and Regional Arts Councils. Once it gets to that point, the Regional Arts Council system itself, the forum, has come up with a formula that boils down how each Regional Arts Council gets their allocation. And it's a consensus, actually an overwhelming consensus of how that formula is put together, and it seems to work really well for us. So the next slide, as Sue mentioned earlier, was talking that really kind of talks to demand. It talks about the number of applications, and when I look at that number, it's kind of staggering, but that's just a testimony to all the good work that's going on out there. It also shows that really we're only meeting about 50% of that demand. And what that tells me really is two things. I was kind of thinking about that on the drive down here this morning. Again, it talks about what I mentioned before, is there is that huge momentum happening in the state of Minnesota right now. because we're only serving about 50% of that. But the other thing that tells me is that really constituents are seeing the Minnesota State Arts Board and the Regional Arts Councils as really the go-to place for legacy arts funding and services. So, you know, that's telling me that, you know, we're really, the folks are comfortable with the process, they're comfortable with the agencies, and more money would always be great.
All right. We wanted to spend a little time talking about the specific kinds of programs and the kinds of grantees that we are serving at the Minnesota State Arts Board, and then Mark will talk more broadly about the the Regional Arts Councils. This first slide, just very quickly, is an organization called Kairos. It's a dance company that works with older adults, goes to senior centers, now has been, with funding from the Arts Board, has been going to veterans' homes. And what they find is that the physical activity and the intellectual activity of dance and movement has significantly improved the quality of life for seniors. And this is a program that now has been not only recognized here in Minnesota, but nationally, and has been getting a lot of attention for the work that they're doing with older adults. So what the Arts Board did with the legacy funds that it had available is, you saw the slide a minute ago, there's arts and arts access dollars, there's arts education, arts and cultural heritage. We are using arts and arts access dollars in five different grant programs, and then for professional development. The first, operating support, it's about 150 to 160 of Minnesota's most important, most well-established arts organizations. It's the backbone of the arts community. It's everything from the Guthrie and the Children's Theater to the Commonweal in Lanesboro, and to the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony Orchestra in Moorhead, Minnesota, and the Fergus Falls Center for the Arts in Fergus Falls. It is the thing that allows those organizations to be available and accessible to their audiences. We do some data gathering from that group of people every year, and we find that beyond their main stage shows, beyond their exhibitions, beyond their performances, they do education, they do outreach programs. They reach about 2.5 million people a year, producing about 30,000 different activities. That might be workshops, it might be master classes, it might be a concert in a community center. It's just a whole variety of ways that those organizations are serving the state. A couple of other examples I'll give you. We created an arts tour program. I will admit we're not very good at naming grant programs. We're not very clever. Basically, as the name suggests, we move artists around the state of Minnesota. So a Duluth organization might go to Rochester, or a Marshall organization might go to Fergus Falls. We funded a program, we funded it twice. It's a Twin Cities theater artist, a gentleman named Laverne Seifert, who teaches at the University of Minnesota, is a professional actor. We gave him a first grant to pilot a project in New Ulm, Minnesota. He produced he took five or six professionals, theater professionals from the Twin Cities. He went out and he produced a production of The Cherry Orchard, Chekhov's Cherry Orchard, which is about a family in Russia losing their family estate, losing their land because of the economic times. He piloted the program in New Ulm, and it was such a success that he came back to us for a second grant, and they went to five other communities. And the play is performed in historic homes. So in New Ulm, it was performed in the Lind home. In Taylor's Falls, it was performed in a home that was owned by the Musser family. In Kenyon, it was performed in the Gunderson house. And it was really, it was performed in places where the farm and home foreclosure rates were particularly high, because obviously that's what the play is about. And the reason they do this is two things. One, they go out and they select local actors and production people to work with them, so there's theater training that's involved. But it's also the political and it's the personal issues of the play. And they collected comments from attendees, and one of them that I found particularly compelling, because I grew up on a farm that's still in my family, one of the audience members said, "We're farmers ourselves, and we're faced with similar circumstances right now. This land has been in our family for over 100 years. How do you let it go?" And so a play like that, which many people might think, well, it's just theater, really opened up some ways of communicating about the problems that they were dealing with. Another of the new programs that we have that you'll see on this slide is called Partners in Arts Participation. Another not great name, sorry. But those are grants to social service organizations, human service organizations that want to use the arts as a tool in the work, in the important work that they do. And I have an example from a program in Duluth called the Scottish Rite Foundation that has a theater program for children who have autism. And obviously these are young people who would not be able to succeed in a regular theater class or a regular theater program. But the comment that I had from them is that the program has opened up new options for children who so desperately need social outlets, who need to develop their language skills. The joy on a parent's face was evident when their child could go on stage and actually use words to express themselves, to introduce a co-actor, or play a simple role. And so for those 50 students and their families, it's making a significant difference in their lives. In our arts education programs, we have two different ways that we're funding things. We're funding community arts schools and conservatories. So whether you're 3 years old or you're 83 years old, if you want to learn to play the cello, or if you want to learn to make ceramics, or if you want to learn to write poetry, we want there to be places that you can do that. We're also funding lifelong learning in the arts, as the name implies, and it can range from a program in a school to something that's in a community center. And two examples I have for you is that Vocal Essence, which is a very well-known world-class organization here in the Twin Cities, has a long-standing partnership with artists and composers from Mexico. They brought two composers from Mexico to Minnesota, and they had them work with schools here in the Twin Cities, but then they also took them to Worthington, which has a very diverse population. And they had youngsters, grade schoolers, second graders, third graders, fourth graders, working with these composers from Mexico, learning the songs, learning about the culture, and sharing their culture. And it was a great way to, as Mark said earlier, bridge racial or ethnic divides through song, through community, through common activities. Another of the programs we fund is something called Two Dance. It's actually two dancers, Tony and Yuri, so the T and the U together. And they have a brand new dance center located in St. Paul in the St. Anthony neighborhood. They both dance with Alvin Ailey, who is the premier African-American choreographer. It's one of the most important dance companies in New York City. They've both moved to Minnesota now, and they're teaching young people. They're reaching out especially to African-American youngsters and youngsters who have low economic means, and bringing them in for free classes or reduced-price classes. And what they're doing is serving as role models, that African-Americans are dancers, they are athletes, they are stars, and they can compete and be part of the greatest arts organizations in the country if they work hard and they're committed to their craft. Then the last category is arts and cultural heritage, and we have a variety of programs there, two that I'll share with you. In our folk and traditional grant program, we have funded an organization called Kajug. It's in Minneapolis, and it's a Somali organization, and they just presented 8 weeks of workshops and classes and activities in poetry, storytelling, and music. And the reason they're doing this, and this is something that I didn't know before reading the proposal, is that in the Somali culture, poetry, proverbs, riddles, and other genre are used as acts of communication. They play a significant role in even the traditional courts and in tribal and in political affairs in Somalia. And so the way we revere our national leaders and heroes, that's the way poets are revered in Somali culture. So this is a way for young people to be brought into the storytelling and the poetry traditions. And my last example was, My last example was one of our Minnesota Festival Support Grants. It was in Winona. It's called the Winona Dakota Unity Alliance. It's an organization that put on what they called the Great Gathering. It was to commemorate the U.S.-Dakota conflict of 1862. It happened just this past September. Brought artists from, basically what they were trying to do was to welcome back to Minnesota peoples who have been forced to leave, peoples whose homes were here along the Minnesota River Valley in the late 1800s, but now have moved to South Dakota and Nebraska and as far away as Manitoba and Alberta, brought them back to share their arts and crafts and have a welcoming back to the Winona community. And so that's one of the projects that we've funded through that program. I'm going to hand off to Mark and let him talk about what's happening with the Regional Arts Council.
All right. You, Sue?
Specific question from Ms. Jens at this point? Okay.
Go ahead. Thank you. Obviously, this slide with the four bullet points is not all the programs that the Regional Arts Councils have. Across the state, it would actually literally be pages and pages of different programs, 11 Regional Arts Councils, as you can imagine, with the thousands of projects, so I don't have examples for all of them. The one thing I do want to highlight under this arts access is a similar story with at-risk youth. I know, and this comes from just from my own Regional Arts Council in the community of Little Falls. It's called the U-Rock program, and works with social services, the school counselors, and a variety of law enforcement as well, and takes at-youth children, typically young men, between ages of 10 and 16, and turns them into rock stars for the summer. They get a lot of high-quality instruction on how to play whatever their instrument of choice, whether it's drums or guitar, even down to the cowbell and cymbals. But what it does, it's really focusing those kids on art, of course, but even more than that. It's teaching kids respect. It's teaching kids how to have the confidence that they need to really turn into productive citizens. We just had a celebration of those kids that went through the program last summer at our office, and it really was just inspiring to see those young men and some young women come in. They performed and were quite good, I have to say. But it was what really caught me is the respect that those kids had for their mentors and for everyone else around them. It really had some transformation in their lives. And I really truly believe that without legacy dollars and using those legacy dollars to touch those kids, they would be much different people today. So that's really making a difference. Move on to arts education. Again, Regional Arts Council is doing a lot of similar things, actually, as the Minnesota State Arts Board. In arts education, we deal with lifelong learning as well. We do work probably more closely with schools than the Minnesota State Arts Board does, and been very successful with that. It's really, really again coming back to the grassroots nature of the regional arts councils. And I want to be clear that that's when I say working with schools, it's really non-curriculum stuff. It's either bringing artists in for something that supplements the arts education that's already going into school. And what I'm seeing more and more of anymore is actually more of that after-school type of programs. And I'll mention one that
okay,
actually
we have
is happening.
A couple of people who want to get into the council. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair. I'm interested in how your Regional Arts Council works with public broadcasting, the amateur stations or the TV stations in your region.
Sure, the representative. We work in partnership. We don't have grants. We haven't had grants to go out to public TV or public radio. We're in constant communication with them about arts activities. Actually, finding individual artists. They come to us and use us as a resource of finding those individual artists that they might want to profile for some of their programming, and that's been very successful and actually just wonderful for a lot of, I know, our artists in our particular region, but and I think across the state.
Madam Chair, just to follow up on that, did they participate in when you had that summer camp for the rock stars? Were they involved with that at all?
You know, thank you, Representative. They didn't broadcast the whole thing, but there has been clips of that on there, and actually it happened in Little Falls, which in particular has their own studio, actually, in the art center there. So they used that as a promotion tool for the Green Fair Festival, which all the kids actually presented at. And there I don't know if that answers your question or not, but there was participation there.
Getting around to it.
Yeah.
And Madam Chair, one more. And then what about the programs in the libraries?
Can you be more specific?
Regional, in your area library, since your regional arts council worked with that?
Yes, and I'm, again, just speaking with to my particular regional arts council, which is the Five Wings in Staples. We work with our libraries and actually finding artists to help out with their programming. So that's been a great partnership. And we have partnered in a couple other projects, actually, in promotion, I guess, is really the biggest partnership that we've had with the libraries. Okay.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Turner or Ms. Gins, you know, sadly, arts education in our public school system has been cut significantly over the past decade, and art classes eliminated significantly in the K-12 system. So has this put a higher demand and request for your arts education programs to come into the schools, and do you get more and more of that each year, or has it not, because we haven't been, you know, funding that in public education, are you getting more of a demand of that?
Which one?
Thank you, Representative Ward.
Either one.
Yes. And what's happening is there is more demand, and there's schools are coming to us to do a lot of those after school programs. And we're very clear that, you know, right now we're restricted that we can't use our funding. And I think it's a slippery slope indeed to use that for core curriculum, which the schools should be doing themselves. What I do see is our community arts organizations really picking up the ball then. For example, in my region and in your district, to represent Ward, the Crossing Arts Alliance does a banner job of providing arts education up and above what the school is doing. And somewhere, just the example I was going to use in Staples as well, they call it their Arts Academy, which is an after-school program which Legacy Dollars help fund. And that's they actually we've had an exhibit of their work in the last couple of years, and it's quite amazing. So the programming is happening. We are getting more demand. I don't know if that answers your question or not. I guess that's where we're at.
Thank you. It does.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, then we'll move on to arts and cultural heritage. What your slide talks about is public art programs, arts and cultural heritage grants. Actually, interesting. This is a photo that you see here is in Representative Ward's district up in Pequot Lakes, and this is a great project. On the side of the drugstore up in Pequot Lakes, and this was funded through a Five Wings Legacy grant of a true public mural, because in this particular project, actually, folks were encouraged, there was paints and supplies on the sidewalk, and anybody walking by could come by at any moment during the project and pick up a brush and put a stroke on, and was a Representative Ward was
Did
talking
Representative
earlier.
Did Ward go by and do it?
Madam Chair, thank you for that question. I was scheduled, and then I had another constituent problem, so I was not able to get there. But I have seen it. It's remarkable. It's exactly what should be happening in our communities with arts money. So
the next time we do one, we think you'll be there.
I will absolutely be there, Madam Chair.
So the art world got lucky because you couldn't paint?
Representative Riddle, that is correct. Yes.
I saw a spray can in your car.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and then I'll wrap up just by talking about impact. As you can see, you know, a staggering number of people reached with Legacy Dollars. But even just going back to the previous slide, that little grant in Pequot Lakes for that mural, the things that Representative Ward thinks should be happening around it, that was just such a small investment. Literally a $600 grant to the city of Pequot Lakes made that happen. And the mayor there has a great story, and I'm remiss I didn't have the quote from her today. But the mayor of Pequot Lakes is just ecstatic about that project. Said it really has had a lot of impact for their community, economically, for the state of mind and the quality of life for their people in Pequot Lakes. So.
Okay, Representative
Bertle. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question of I guess both of you or either of you. You know, one of the items that we discussed a fair amount last session. Dealt with reporting and the requirements that we have for transparency and accountability, and just wondering how you felt that worked over the last year.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Jones.
Representative Erdahl, it's a conversation that we continue to have with the Regional Arts Councils and the Arts Board together. We're absolutely with you on needing to be transparent and making sure people understand where the dollars go. There have been a couple of places where we've had a little bit of a snag, and we were able to work those out. There are some things, some specific details about what's being reported that we'll probably want to come back to the committee and talk about, whether there is a substitute way to do it, or in the case of a Regional Arts Council, for example, or the Arts Board even. The Arts Board makes 500 to 600 grants a year, and we're reporting the names of our board members 500 to 600 times in the database because it's attached to every grant. And so each Regional Arts Council is making maybe 100 or 150 grants a year. The names of their board members are attached to 150 records. So there is some repetition, but that's a factor of the technology, and maybe we can come back and talk to you about some of those things.
Thank you.
Okay. How it, as we go through this, it seems that there's a lot of overlap between what the State Arts Board is doing and the Regional Arts Councils are doing. How do you kind of deal with that? How do you look that you're not funding the same project, or you're not, giving people different, such different instructions that they don't know where to go. How does that work?
Madam Chair, I'll start off, and then maybe Mark will add some things. One of the things that we continue to have this conversation with the Regional Arts Council is obviously with new monies, we all were able to expand what we were doing. Here's some general rules of thumb. Larger requests, larger organizations, larger projects come to the Arts Board. Something that's small, $500 or $600, is much better to go to the Regional Arts Council level. The Arts Board doesn't make grants of $500 to $600. The smallest grant we will make is $5,000, and we're thinking maybe that's even too small. It might be different. The other thing that's true is that the Arts Board has tried to pick out certain kinds of things that it wants to use its money to be an incentive for, like touring, like I didn't talk about our Arts Access program, and it's not really about accessibility for people with disabilities. It's about arts organizations identifying underserved communities that they'd like to work with and working together to break down those barriers in some meaningful way. And so we've created programs that are really very specific with some outcomes in mind. And I think Mark might say that the Regional Arts Council programs maybe are a little broader than that. Mm-hmm. And maybe you want to add something to that. But those are some general different distinctions.
Yeah, I think Sue, you did a good job of summing that up. I just want to add is, or reiterate again, that yes, we are talking about it. That's how we're handling it. And actually, recently in the last year, we're more actively talking about it because now we've kind of taken our breath from that influx of legacy dollars and really taking a really smart look at all of our programming and those processes that go along with that. So we actually have a structured conversation that has already begun, and it's ongoing to really look at all those things. Do some overlaps make sense? And I think what Sue really hit it on the head is the Regional Arts Councils really see themselves, I think, as incubators and grassroots, as I mentioned several times, in the field as incubators to a certain degree, and really kind of put those fledglings up to the State Arts Board level, if you will. So it makes sense right now.
Okay. Any other questions? I guess I'm interested in it's a question we may deal with a little bit later, but what do you have a tab on the amount of legacy dollars that have gone to organizations that may not be using them as you made a grant to them? I'm specifically interested in the Minnesota Orchestra and the St. Paul mm-hmm. Chamber. Are there legacy dollars that they have right now, and what's happening with those?
Madam Chair, we are providing a grant to both the, to both the Minnesota Orchestra and the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra. Those were approved in July for the fiscal year. And we are monitoring what's happening with those two organizations. Obviously, our goal, I think we all have the same goal, which is that those two organizations will resolve their issue and will get back to playing and providing services to Minnesotans. Those organizations are very large, as you know. The grants that we are able to provide to them represent somewhere between 10 and 14 days of programming. If you take a year and you parse it out. And they both were operating for 3 months at the beginning of the year before the lockouts happened. But what they are doing is they're sequestering the funds from the Arts Board until the time that the lockouts are resolved and they're playing again.
So they're totally sequestered. They didn't say that we spent them all in the first 3 months. Or
they may have spent some in the first 3 months, but we started a conversation with them in November about where things stood and where we were going, and they've been sequestering since then.
Great. Any other questions? Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering about, is there an appeals process? You're early enough. People are still working through. My understanding was at least one seemed to feel there had been a change in a deadline or something, and established groups didn't get grants. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's a place to take an appeal.
Madam Chair? Representative yes. Hausman, there is. We have an appeals process, and I think the regional arts councils have similar appeals processes. The Arts Board has the ability to promulgate rules, so our appeals process is in the state's administrative rules. Basically says that an applicant that feels that we have failed to follow our policies or procedures, that somehow they have been treated differently than everyone else, or we have not been above board in working with them, can appeal based on that. That they can show that we have somehow failed to follow policies or procedures. We don't allow appeals if an applicant feels that we made the wrong decision about a grant application. That, you know, I do a particular art form and you just didn't understand my art form, and so therefore you should have given me a grant. We have had that same appeals process in place the 11 years that I've been at the Arts Board, and we get maybe one or two appeals per year. And we do have one appeal that's still in process at the moment. So there is a first step with our board, and in our case, if the board's decision is not satisfactory to the appellant, we then go to the Office of Administrative Hearings. And that's where we are with one particular situation. And I'm happy to talk with you more about any details you'd like about. I think I know what you're referring to, but happy to have that conversation.
Okay. The, one of the other things that I'm, and it's almost as if you've kind of been listening to some of the things that I've said that we wanted you guys to do, and you're already doing it, which is the outreach to disadvantaged groups, the outreach to specific groups in specific. And, of course, that's why the regional arts councils were set up initially, was to put some of the decision off in a more local area, and then to like even the playing field so that something like the Thief River Fife and Drum Corps didn't have to compete with the Minnesota Orchestra for funding. One of the other things I think I want to start talking about, and I don't want to make it a requirement clearly, is the concept of matching funds and also the concept of return on investment, which may be more for a state's arts board type thing than for, and this is talking about I guess all of the accounts before this committee, but it's not that I want to make it a criteria for funding or doing it, but I'm just kind of interested in it as information mm-hmm. in terms of, so just sort of putting that out for. Okay. Any other questions? Anna?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I just had a question back on page 7. The slide regarding the 25-year arts legacy strategic goals, and towards the bottom of the slide, and I'll let members get there. It's the bottom slide on page 7. And it says a goal of people would trust Minnesota's stewardship of public arts funding. And I think it goes back to what Chairwoman Cowan said about return on investment. And I was just wondering what kinds of measurements and criteria do you use? Do you do surveys? How do you get that feedback?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I think what you're referring to is the goals that the Regional Arts Councils and Arts Board set for itself. Right. And we want to, as a system, be as accountable as it's possible for us to be, and we want people to believe that that's true. And so some of the things we look at are the audits that come back from the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Do they feel that we are being accountable? And do they feel we're being good stewards of the public dollars. One of the measures, as far as sort of the way the public feels about it, is have there been any media stories? Have there been any issues raised? Have there been any concerns about how the Arts Board or how the regional arts councils together are managing those dollars? And to this day, there really have not been what I would consider controversies or issues that have been raised. So our goal is that your constituents will say to you, we have confidence in the Arts Board and we have confidence in the regional arts councils. That really will be the best measure of whether we're doing our jobs correctly.
Okay, thank you.
Just to follow up, so you're just saying that it's essentially, thank you, essentially it's on behalf or on the part of the public to provide that information. It's not necessarily solicited. Is that what you're saying?
Madam Chair, we do provide information. We our information about our grantees and how we're spending funds is made public. I think what I was meaning is do your constituents, do our constituents feel that they're getting the information they need? Do they feel like we're making fair decisions? Do they feel like the dollars are being allocated in ways that are accomplishing things that they feel are the appropriate things to do? And if they don't, then we want them to tell us that so we can adjust what we're doing, or we want them to tell you that so if you see some needs or some priorities that aren't being met, we can do that. One of the things that's very important about the way we all work is that we can be flexible. None of the programs or the activities that we do are written in stone. If there is a new need or if there is some opportunity that comes up, we have some flexibility to move some things around. So that kind of public input and that kind of public confidence is really important to us.
Okay. I keep forgetting that we have other people on the agenda, too. So thank you very much. And next, we have also asked Mr. Larry Redmond, who represents Minnesota Citizens for the Arts, has also asked to make some comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you. And we do have to fit the Historical Society in a half an hour, so I'll ask you to be.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Larry Redman. I'm here representing Minnesota Citizens for the Arts. You've heard from the mechanism of the state government, both the state entity and then our decentralized system that distributes the money that you appropriate. I'm representing the field that receives the money and produces the art. Minnesota Citizens for the Arts has existed for many, many years, and for well over 30-some years, and has been the primary advocate for public support of the arts in the state of Minnesota. I understand that at a future hearing, we're going to have an opportunity to bring in some of the field to answer very specific questions and show you the application and the good works that are being done with this extraordinary thing that the people of our state put in place, known as the Legacy Amendment, at least in regards to the arts. My charge today from committee chair was to really kind of just talk briefly about kind of more philosophic issues about where this has been at. And so with your leave, I'll kind of stay at 10,000 feet, looking for that opportunity to give specific applications at a later point. Just to put that in context, and if you give me leave for a while, when I look around this table and indeed around this room, I see many people I've known for many, many years. Some people who I don't know as well because they're new to the institution or I just haven't had the chance to work with them before, but I look forward to that. If you'll indulge me, this will make sense later. It's not a walk down memory lane, but I've been around here for a very, very long time. I started spending time around here as a staffer in 1973, and in fact, the first time I ever sat in a chair testifying, it was 1969, and I was 17 years old. So today is an interesting occasion to be talking about this particular subject, which is of great, you know, personal interest to me, and one of the things I'm extremely proud to represent. This committee has purview over far more than the arts funding, of course, the Historical Society, but indeed the whole of the Legacy Amendment. The arts section is just 19.75%. You have a fiduciary charge over a much more substantial amount of money. And as many of you know, during the time that the legislature was putting together the Legacy Amendment, there was some, at times, conflict as to who ought to be included. I think it's important to understand that while there may have been conflict at that time, a very remarkable thing happened as we prepared a campaign called Vote Yes Campaign at that time to pass this constitutional amendment. It's remarkable because I think it speaks to the importance of this extraordinary part of our Constitution. Groups that were not completely enamored of each other, oftentimes the arts groups and the hunters and anglers aren't always in the same strategy meetings, but groups that weren't always enamored of each other actually became great allies, and in many cases even personal friends. Once we got beyond the legislature and went to the public, there were alliances made. Because what we found, I believe, in all these groups is that there was a commonality between television and arts, arts and public broadcasting, arts and hunting and angling, arts and the parks. The common denominator was that in some ways what we are not, as much as what we are, we're not the primary function of the state of Minnesota. We're not health care. We're not K-12 education. We're not the roads and the transit systems that carry our people about. And yet, we are an essential part of who Minnesotans are as a people. And we are things that the marketplace itself does not support. Therefore, it requires private contribution and state support in some way for that to happen. This is an essential thing, and it's a very remarkable thing, and we can't say this too many times, that the Minnesota people decided that these issues were so important that they would enshrine them in the Constitution. In regards to the arts, I want you to know that Minnesota is the only government that I think I know of on the planet has actually enshrined arts funding in its Constitution. That's a pretty remarkable statement, and a statement that was made by the people that we ought to do that. Well, why did that happen? What is the background that led up to that? And for that, I'd go back to perhaps maybe even the late 19th century, our founding. Because I'm not going to go through all those years, don't worry. In the late 19th century, if you were to tell the people, particularly the East Coast, of the great capitals of America, New York, Philadelphia, Boston, and so forth, that in the middle of the continent, there would be some significant art activity, people would say, well, that's absurd. That's not going to happen. That'll never take place. And yet, and prior to government of the state of Minnesota taking an active role, the people of this state, through their private contributions, through their direct participations, built what was one of the most significant arts communities that exists, not just in this nation, but in this world. There are more arts organizations in this state, and not just in the Twin Cities, all over. 60%, there are 1,700 arts organizations in the state of Minnesota. That is a remarkable number. And I want you to know 60% of them are outside the metropolitan area. This is an activity that is in every county of our state, in every community. It is not owned by any economic group, by any geographic group, or anybody else. This is something that everybody is concerned about. No wonder that the people would say, when they voted for our legacy amendment, that this was important. But as the Minnesota economy has changed in the latter 20th century, now into the 21st century, some of the very significant wealth that our state was blessed with that helped fund some of these activities and this outreach that was all over started to take a redirection. Our economic systems were changing. In some cases, some of our companies that had been so tremendously successful felt that they had obligations to other parts of the country. And likewise, as the economic structure changes, philanthropy changes. Now, there's more philanthropy going on, but there are also more arts organizations and more social service organizations that needed to serve. So as a result of that, the ability for the arts organizations of our state, small and large, urban and rural, to function, couldn't accept the luxury of not having a collective contribution, that is, a contribution from the state of Minnesota, to make their operating budgets work. Now, they were not looking for the state to take over the responsibility. They said, look, we built this ourselves, but we do need to have something more than 1%, say, of our operating budgets being covered by the state of Minnesota. We'd like to get something high. The largest organizations in the state, I can tell you right now, we're at about 3%, a very significant. But I must tell you, that is generally the largest contributor that any of them receive. And if that 3% were to go away, that money will not be there, and that means that money will not be there to do the outreach to various underserved communities, to minority communities, to older people, and most certainly to children because one of the common things with all these organizations is vast service of a very, very large number of our young people. Representative Ward, you asked a question early about the schools, the systems and so forth. That question is absolutely right. We, in another issue years ago, Minnesota Citizens for the Arts, were part of a lobbying effort to add arts education as a graduation requirement. That was a struggle here. But the reality is that funding for that school, the schools is often cut short in the arts. And yet there's a larger public that wants it. We can't keep covering all this, these things through all these activities. We have to somehow fortify these institutions. Now, during the last many years, when economic struggles of the state have been substantial, just as private philanthropy in many cases is going down, the demands of state government funding for health and human service, for transportation, for those vital and core elements of the state, cause arts funding to be dropped. If you look, and we'll show you those numbers later, there was a very substantial and a disproportionate share of reductions in funding for the state arts boards and regional arts councils, and of course, therefore, to the larger community who I'm here representing today. Those numbers dropped, and it was disproportionate. In one particular budget shortfall, when the state was facing a 14% shortfall, the arts were cut by 32% that year. Our general, and by the way, our dollars, every dollar is so very, very important to us, and we take it so very, very important. But frankly, as a percentage of the state budget, these are not substantially large budget numbers in that regard. And yet, we were asked to take a bigger hit than was proportional. We understood that. Our argument was always that it ought to be proportional. But we took our lumps and we went through it. But what it did cause was that when we heard about the legacy amendment, and frankly when we were approached by some other people who were part of the legacy amendment, who wanted the Alliance of the Arts, we said, well, here's a way to maybe try to ensure some kind of stability, some kind of funding for this system, so we won't be victimized by that circumstance, because we'll have other budget shortfalls in the future. And the demands, particularly of health and human services, are only going to grow greater and greater in our society. That isn't just a state, a government problem. That's a societal problem. But yet we had to have that support. And that was the reason to move forward on that legacy amendment in that particular regard. Now, I mentioned before we have 1,700 arts organizations throughout this state that are very, very sick in that regard. There are over 38,000 people who make their living and they define their occupation as artists in this state. This is a remarkable number of people in that regard. The State Arts Board showed before that there are, that if you look at number of participants in arts organizations, the staggering number of 24 million participants in some fashion, it's obviously people doing it over and over again. Furthermore, it is one of our state's trademarks, where 100 years ago people said that this is not going to happen in the Midwest. Now, the state of Minnesota, whether you live in the Twin Cities or you live in the northwestern corner in Warren, Minnesota, the arts are one of the defining features of what our state is. That activity has been very, very significant in that regard. The legacy amendment is a gigantic success. It's been enormously helpful to the state. The way to measure in the future, I think, the best measure, if we could look forward and see whether we provided a legacy. And by the way, if you look up legacy in Webster's, you'll see that legacy refers to something being given to the future, and which makes this particular work, this charge you have, so particularly important. But I think if we could look 20 years future in the future and see if this was a success, the key will be, is there somebody sitting here, presumably not me, who will say that there are more than 1,700 organizations serving that, and that they can show that the demand of the public justifies that number of organizations, as indeed we can, and that we've met those challenges, including the school children's needs as it happens.
Okay.
We appreciate your support, and we look forward to working with you over the coming months.
Representative Hasman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to actually name an organization, because I'm wondering as we move into this, whether we're prepared for flexibility or the ability to suddenly shift priority. And I'm thinking of the Penumbra Theater. And I mean, I think if you think of one with national impact, and they were in trouble and had to cancel a season, and. You know, I don't know how that fits our conversation today, but it just seemed to me that there was a need for us as a state to be able to have a conversation at that moment and shift priorities in order to be part of saving an institution that there are not many of in the country, much less Minnesota. So I don't know if you can help with that.
Madam Chair, Representative Hausman. There are always unique and particular circumstances with all these difficulties any of these organizations have, and indeed that is the case with the Penumbra Theater, which is an enormously important organization, not just to our state, but to our nation. And those are, happily, we're seeing some good things happening there, but there are miles to go on that front. The State Arts Board and the Regional Arts Councils have rigorous systems because the legislature, quite reasonably, has demanded high levels of accountability. Because we don't expect anybody to just be writing checks and not show that accountability. We want to be called to task in that regard. In terms of dealing with these emergencies, quite frankly, there's a practical issue for the state, I think, because if, in fact, there is a shift of resource, for instance, within the arts money, that means that some other organization is going to have less money, and there are none of these folks that are flush with cash. Now, and I don't mean to be glib, if in fact the legislature wanted to shift money from some other activity to the arts to deal with those areas, we, of course, would be very eager to have that discussion. The problem we have systemically is that if we're going to start to do that, I think we're going to find a systemic problem with the system. So I would caution. This is a conversation we have all the time. And by the way, when we say there are 1,700 organizations, I must tell you, at any time, in any week, there are probably two of those organizations that are going away because they don't have an audience that's gone away. But I must also tell you that same week there are three more being born.
And Madam Chair, maybe just to you and the committee, I mean, you know what it occurs to me is that maybe there's got to be sort of this residual fund, and we've often talked about that in the case of, this is a totally other thing that I use as an example, but when we have a flood, you know, disaster relief, instead of just always reacting and making decisions to one event, that we plan ahead and we have some parameters, you know, should this occur, and that there's a sort of a contingency fund. And I don't know if that's something to think about in this regard, because you're right, you wouldn't want to shift it from promised funds.
Madam Chair, we have a lot of floods.
Yeah.
So I'd caution in that regard. But I think that conversation is a good thought. But every day we get calls, and the State Arts Board and the Regional Arts calls, I'm sure to get calls from folks who think their problem is greater than everybody else's. Yeah. Part of the difficult task these groups have is trying to measure that and sort that out. This is a complicated question, because in my heart, yeah, we're totally with you. The question is, how do we do that and maintain the proper accountabilities for the people's money?
Okay. Thank you. We do need to move on to, again, my apologies to the committee and to the visiting people who are coming. We didn't allocate enough time for things, but we'll certainly start at least with the Historical Society at this point. And we promise, if you don't get to say everything you wanted to say, that you'll come back again.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. We've got a presentation I think we can step through crisply.
Okay.
And we, of course, welcome your questions. We appreciate the opportunity to report today on our work with others to preserve.
Sorry, could you please give your name for the tape and the committee?
Yes, I'm
Thank
sorry.
You. And your position?
I'm Stephen Elliott. I'm the director of the Minnesota Historical Society, accompanied today by David Kelleher, our director of public policy, and deputy director for programs, Pat Carter.
Thank you very much.
Yes. So we have a good story to tell you about the work that's being done to preserve and share the stories of Minnesota's history through the Legacy Amendment. We now have nearly 4 years of experience with the Legacy Amendment, and the results are impressive. I express our appreciation to you, Madam Chair, for today's hearing, and also to Representative Murphy and Representative Erdahl, the two previous chairs, for getting us off to a great start with this work. We all have been given an extraordinary opportunity by the voters of Minnesota, and with that opportunity has come great responsibility that we deliver results in an accountable and transparent manner. And we've taken this responsibility very seriously, and we have carefully considered and listened to the language of the Constitution, the appropriations language, the House Legacy Guide, guidance from the Office of the Legislative Auditor, with whom we consulted early on, guidance from MMB and the Department of Administration's Office of Grants Management, much input from constituents in the field, including both the history field and conversations that were a part of the 10-year plan and 25-year vision for the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. We see this as a continuous learning and listening process, and we'll strive to continue to deliver the positive results we've seen in the first two biennia of legacy funding. So today, we're pleased to present to you a report detailing expenditures from legacy funds in the current biennium. And so there's much information in this report, and we won't attempt to go through all of that here this afternoon. On page two, there are a few highlights, what the History and Heritage Committee has been able to accomplish with the History Legacy dollars. So here are some numbers from page two. 87, the number of counties to which we have made grants under the Legacy History Grants Program. 100%, that's the return on investment according to the University of Minnesota Extension Center for Community Vitality. Each legacy dollar spent returns $2 to the state's economy. $2.34. That's the cost of history legacy programs annually for each Minnesotan. Less than a gallon of gasoline, much less, and or a gallon of milk to preserve our state's history for future generations. More than 500 grants have been made statewide in this biennium alone. 10,000 teachers have more resources, tools, and training thanks to legacy programs. 500,000 students are benefiting from statewide history programs. 3 to 1. 3 to 1 is the level of demand for grants based on applications for programs, partnerships, and grants. In other words, we're meeting 1/4 of the requested funding to preserve Minnesota's history and cultural heritage. Madam Chair and members of the committee, history legacy programs have been enormously successful. We communicate legacy results in a number of ways, both through this report and in this short video, which summarizes the accomplishments of this biennium's legacy projects.
Funding from Minnesota's Legacy Amendment, the Minnesota Historical Society is building a richer gift, a more complete gift for future generations. The Legacy Amendment helps us preserve more of our past, from Roseau to Red Wing, War Road to Worthington. 1,000 grants are preserving historic buildings, artifacts, and stories in every county in Minnesota. In Isanti County,
we were just stunned.
Grants are saving what's left of important collections, almost destroyed in an arson fire.
Without the opportunity to apply for those grants and get funding, I don't know how we would do it.
The Legacy Amendment helps us share more of our state stories. With the newest generation of Minnesotans. New exhibits.
Don't go too fast, you're going to tire out.
Websites, oral histories.
If we don't know our roots and how we're connected, the tree falls and it dies.
Field trips, fellowships, interactive history lessons, and much more.
We're on the top of the state capitol!
are benefiting 500,000 Minnesota students.
6%.
The Legacy Amendment helps us connect more people to history.
It's bringing the youth and the elders together.
Through statewide intergenerational projects, traveling exhibits, library programs, and events that educate, entertain, and celebrate who we are as Minnesotans.
Idea of the website is kind of attractive. I wonder if maybe it ought to make that a requirement for other.
The website gets a lot of people use the website. It's very, very good.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. I'm going to take us on a quick walkthrough of the various programs and describe to you how the history legacy appropriations are organized over the past couple of biennia. When the Legacy Amendment passed in 2008, we gathered members of the history community, county historical societies, historic preservation folks, and got together and discussed what we wanted to do as a community with the Legacy Amendment. Of course, the words "to preserve Minnesota's history" are mentioned in the Constitution. We're very excited about that. We held a series of town hall meetings and listening sessions and formed a ad hoc, loosely knit group called the Minnesota History Coalition, the groups that I just mentioned, to determine what we wanted to do, what our vision for the future was. And what we came up with was a series of recommendations that became the basis or the framework of what you adopted in 2009 in the first legacy appropriations. So you can see on this slide the basis of these appropriations, which are really centered on a grants program, a statewide grants program that's a competitive grants program that I'll describe in a little more detail. Secondly, there are a series of statewide programs. These are programs that are operated by the Minnesota Historical Society. There are partnerships, and there are two other programs related to archaeology and the second related to an ongoing effort, the Minnesota Digital Library, that's been around for a number of years. The sixth element in that chart up on the screen is Then Now Wow, which is an exhibit on Minnesota history that you saw in the video, and that was a specific appropriation made in 2009 for that exhibit. First, on the grants program, as I mentioned, this is a competitive grants program. It's awarded nearly 1,000 grants in the first two biennia in all 87 counties. These grants go for the various work that history organizations do, as well as historic preservation purposes. These grants range in size from small grants, several hundred dollars, up to several hundred thousand dollars. And what we've done is we've created categories in order to organize those for the applicants, for the applicant process. We've tried to make it convenient for the grant applicants by having the small grants, those under $7,000, available on a rolling monthly basis, as long as dollars are available. We need to give hats off to our staff who have adapted in this large volume of grants. They, before the Legacy Amendment, ran on the order of several dozen grants. Now they're in the hundreds, up to 1,000. They've converted to a paperless grant system so that the grant reviewers, the Historic Resources Advisory Committee, doesn't have to have a stack of paper. They have a bank of laptops when they do their work and get together. So we've really made this easy both for the applicants and for the reviewers, which is a good segue to mentioning that we do have a Citizens Review Committee that was created in the appropriation legislation in 2009 as well as in 2011. It's a 15-member committee with statewide representation and then also representation across the disciplines of history, of the work that we do. Those members are dedicated, and we ask them to tally up their hours, and they spent 500 hours, which is an average of 38 per person over the course of the last fiscal year, so they're extremely dedicated. The report that you have in front of you has a detail of every single grant that we've made in this biennium. So it's organized geographically, and you can take a look. We have statewide distribution of these grants. You can see on the map within the book, as well as on the map up on the screen. So we'd be happy to answer any questions. We're not going to go through all 500, but there's some good work going on out in the field. The second major group in this appropriation is statewide programs. These are programs primarily operated by the Minnesota Historical Society, and we've used as a framework to do this reporting our mission statement, which says that we will use the power of history to transform lives by preserving, sharing, and connecting. So if we think of those areas, the booklet is organized in that way as well. And each of the projects that we carry out are described in detail in the report, so we can answer any questions that you may have on the specific projects. Under the preserving grouping, a couple of examples would include digitizing collections, newspaper collections, and other collections that are out there across the state. And then at Jeffers Petroglyphs, one of our really important historic sites in southwest Minnesota, that environmental conditions are changing the petroglyphs, so we want to record the information that we can gather from the petroglyphs at this time. Under sharing, we have a major initiative with the U.S. Dakota War of 1862 and the Civil War sesquicentennial. We've done extensive work in those two areas, again described in the report. We've done teacher training, and we have a feature on our website called Minipedia, which is similar to Wikipedia that I'm sure you've all heard of, but it has Minnesota topics on Minnesota history. Under the connecting category, this work largely surrounds educational efforts. And at our heart, we're an educational organization, and we have extensive dealings with school groups. And you can see on this example, History Live is an interactive program where we go out across the state into schools via interactive television and actually do history lessons for schools that can't make it into St. Paul or to one of our historic sites. We have the Legacy Field Trip Support Fund to help those organizations that are school groups that can't make it, that don't have the financial wherewithal to come on a field trip to a historic site, to help them out, etc. And there are many, many other examples, and again, in the interest of time, I won't go through in greater detail on that. A third of the five categories of the appropriation is history partnerships. And when we were setting this up, we saw the need to encourage history organizations, both the Minnesota Historical Society and local historical organizations, to work together, to share expertise, to share resources, and come up with a better product by working together. And there are a couple of examples. I know there are a few people in the room today that have been collaborators on, for example, libraries and the American Indian Museum Fellowship Program with the Humanities Center and the Indian Affairs Council. So we closely work with many, many other organizations who have an interest in history. The final two, the Statewide Archaeological and Historic Site Survey, is a partnership that we work with the Office of the State Archaeologist and the Indian Affairs Council to get a better handle on what's out there in terms of archaeology across the state. So these surveys will take in geographic areas or themes of history and archaeology and add to the base of knowledge that we have. Finally, the Minnesota Digital Library is a collaboration between the Minnesota Historical Society, Minitech's higher ed organizations, and local libraries, in which we digitize important historical collections and make them available in Minnesota and beyond via technology. And that initiative has worked with school groups as well to make sure that that's accessible to students. I see that Representative Erdahl has left the room temporarily, but the last area that we've been working on is the Civil War commemoration. And last year, the legislature made an appropriation to the Civil War Commemoration Task Force. Representative Erdahl serves as a co-chair of that task force, along with Secretary of State Mark Ritchie. And we as a MHS staff, have worked closely to coordinate the programs that we're doing. And make sure you mark your calendar for March 2nd, when the Minnesota and the Civil War exhibit will open up over at the History Center. So we invite you to come over and check that out. Finally, just a couple of things to look to the future. I mentioned early on the Minnesota History Coalition is the ad hoc group of history organizations. There's a list of the organizations, the Minnesota Council for Minnesota Archaeology, Minnesota Alliance for Local History Museums, Minnesota Archaeological Society, Minnesota Digital Library, Minnesota Genealogical Society, Minnesota's Historic Northwest, Minnesota Historical Society, Minnesota History Advocates for Research, and the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota. That pretty much covers the waterfront of history organizations. That group was the group that I mentioned, got together after the Legacy Amendment passed in 2008 and came up with a recommendation. That group has come up with a recommendation for the upcoming biennium. And there's a sheet in your folder that looks like this that outlines what the Minnesota History Coalition is recommending for the upcoming biennium. And in brief, the coalition is recommending a similar framework with a grants program and statewide programs operated by the Minnesota Historical Society, as well as the archaeology program, the Minnesota Digital Library, and the partnership program. And there are dollar amounts that are spelled out that are based on the demand for grants and the demand for programs that we at MHS have seen. Finally, I would just mention, you heard a little bit of discussion earlier about planning and looking to the future. We at the Minnesota Historical Society are currently in the middle of a planning project where we are looking to the future to see what history will look like over the course of the remaining 20 or 21 years of the Legacy Amendment. So we hope to have a more intentional look at how these dollars are spent, both through the grants program and through the statewide programs. We have some consultants who are helping us go out in the field and do listening sessions and town hall meetings, and they should be done with their work in the spring. So we look forward to wrapping that up as well. So again, Madam Chair, in the interest of time, we did a very quick buzz through a lot of information, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
So if being so fast, does that mean you get an automatic bump up in your appropriation?
We're hoping.
Are there any questions? They'll be back again. Multiple people will be back again. Representative Hauser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the film, one of the it looks like the tragedy is the fire, and she was holding a box of paper, which had to be one of the more difficult to. And of course, what that reminded me of is the Chatfield Music Library, where there are music scores that don't exist anywhere else, and we tried to help them, and they were line item vetoed, and they've never been able to lift up their heads since, I think. And there must be collections of history and paper all over the state. And are we methodically thinking through, because it's the opposite of the sprinkler system, it has to suck the oxygen out of the room. And are we thinking through where we need to save paper from fire?
Madam Chair, Representative Hausman, I would answer that question in a couple of ways. One of the things that we have encouraged organizations to do is to plan how their facilities are used for the future. We have done a number of planning grants where organizations have come in and looked at their heating, ventilation, and air conditioning, HVAC systems, to make sure that those environments are appropriate for their museum so that, like the Isani County Historical Society, if they had a sprinkler system that was an arson, and that may not have happened. So those kinds of things are available for organizations. There are 400 plus historical organizations across the state, and we have field services staff who will help to walk through the best museum practices for those organizations. The other thing that I have to mention about the Isanti fire that you referenced is that that happened during the shutdown, and our employees were not working. And nevertheless, two of our employees went up there over the weekend that day to help them determine what to salvage. Oftentimes, stuff that maybe got wet or is charred gets put into a freezer. So they spent a full weekend while they were on shutdown status helping the local history partner.
Okay. Remind people, probably keep your historical stuff in your folder, because I'm sure we didn't get through it as we should. Any other questions?
And Madam Chair,
okay.
I'm hoping that everybody checked, but under the grants, they nicely have arranged those according to Senate districts, so you can quickly find your way around the state. And there are only 6 out of the 67 Senate districts that didn't have a project.
Okay, very good. Thank you for that extra help in getting through the material. Okay, meeting adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much.